We've been talking the last few weeks about, we've been following the life of David and the trials that he endured. And we've seen and mentioned that we're in 1 Samuel 20. I know you're all anxious. We've mentioned about the fact that God allows trials in our lives to do something either in us or through us that can be done in no other way. And furthermore, something that has eternal value. But that doesn't change the stress that we feel as we go through those things. So far we've observed from David a few responses to his opposition, the obstacles, the resistance that he faced, the persecution, if you will. First of all, we looked at the story of David and Goliath. Very exciting story that we've probably all heard since we were little kids. But we saw in that as David pushed through the resistance that he had, first of all from his brother, and then from Saul, and then from Goliath, and he pushed through that, and ultimately he trusted in God as he went through that. And then as Saul began to turn against David, and David was basically on the run for his life, David fled for safety, and he turned to God for strength. And then last week we read as Saul continued his pursuit of David, David fled to the prophet of God, to Samuel, and to Samuel's hometown, Ramah, where Samuel had his, sounds like a prophet school of some sort. He was with these other prophets. And he found refuge and respite among the men of God. Now I'm sure that any of us here facing the pressures that David faced would be overwhelmed, to say the least. After David experienced his miraculous defeat from Goliath, he defeated Goliath miraculously. And after he experienced that, things went well for him for a very short period of time. And then things quickly turned bad. After each of these times, when David properly handled the oppression, something else happened. It was just like one thing after another after another. He gets through one, and the next one comes. Or he's not even through one, and the next one comes. It was constant for him. And he continued to trust in God. And that's going to continue to be the case as we follow him into 1 Samuel chapter 20 this morning. As we read this, I want you to pay attention to where David turned this time. We've seen the three things he's done so far. He's trusted God. He's leaned on God for his strength. He's gone to the men of God, the prophets of God, which we might call that a church, if you will. But today he's going to go something different. Last week, if you remember, we followed David to Ramah and Na'ith, which was Saul's palaces in Gibeah, not very far away. And here's David amongst these great prophets of God. What a powerful experience that must have been for him. During that time, we assume he wrote Psalm 59 as he cries out to God for strength. And so he's on this spiritual high, surrounded by men who love and seek God. Somewhat protected. Saul gets wind of it, he sends these messengers up. And three different messengers or groups of messengers come to Ramah. And there's such a powerful working of the Holy Spirit. And God is doing something. Also, he comes upon these messengers. And they begin to prophesy. And then Saul himself comes up. Saul experiences the same thing. That's where we left David last week. In the prophet school. And every person that came to get him was impacted by the Spirit of the Lord. And they couldn't. And so this week, we start in chapter 20, verse 1. David is recognized. Saul's incapacitated. If you remember the last verse of chapter 19, basically has him lying there under the influence of the Holy Spirit, prophesying in a very humiliating position, if you read the text. And so David sees this opportunity. Hey, Saul's down. I should probably get going. Where does he go? Verse 1. Then David fled from Naboth in Ramah and came and said before Jonathan, "What have I done? Well, what is my guilt? And what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?" And Jonathan said to him, "Far from it. You shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. And why should my father hide this from me? It is not so." But David bowed again, saying, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your eyes, and he thinks, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved.' But truly, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death." Then Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." This is a very interesting exchange between these two best friends. David expresses his deep confusion over why Saul is after him. "What have I done? What is my guilt that your father is trying to kill me?" And it's a legitimate... David has done nothing against Saul. In fact, he's done everything for Saul. What has David done so far? He's killed Saul's enemies at Saul's request. He has the friendship of his son, and he's married to Saul's daughter, so two of Saul's kids love David. David has played the harp for Saul when Saul's spirit was troubled and calmed his spirit. David has done, he's bent over backwards for Saul, and he's put up with Saul's antics time and again. Certainly he has a right to say, "What have I done?" Because he hasn't done anything. He's been the model soldier, the model son-in-law, the model subject of the king, and yet here he is, on the run. It's also interesting that Jonathan apparently doesn't somehow, reading the text, I'm not sure how, but somehow Jonathan doesn't seem to understand. He says, ESV says, translates it, "It is not so. David, it is not so." I don't quite understand how Jonathan didn't know what was going on. But one thing I do think is Jonathan overestimated the bond he had with his dad. Or at least the bond his dad had with him. Because he says to David, "My dad won't do anything against you without first telling me." And David is careful to emphasize to Jonathan, it's interesting how David puts this, when he says, "Your dad's not going to tell you the plans." He says, because he doesn't want to grieve you, Jonathan. I think David probably knew that didn't matter a bit to Saul. But David is talking to his best friend about his best friend's dad. And David shows respect to Saul and to Jonathan, I think. "Jonathan, your dad, he's not going to tell you that because he doesn't want to hurt your feelings, Jonathan. He wouldn't tell you that stuff." Obviously, Saul didn't care a bit about Jonathan's feelings. We'll find that out later in the chapter. It becomes very apparent. But Jonathan, I think, was oblivious to the hatred Saul had for David. We haven't heard from Jonathan for quite a while now in this account. But here's how David tries to ease him into the idea. Verses 5 and 6. David said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit at table with the king. But let me go that I may hide myself in the field till the third day at evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, 'David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the clan.'" I think when David said, "If your dad misses me at all," do you think David thought Saul might not miss him? David just ran from Ramah to get away from Saul, who came there to get him. His father-in-law is going to miss him. David knows that. There's no question about that. So he he has this scenario that he has set up with Jonathan. Now, traditionally, the first day of the month, the new moon month, would have been a festival, a sacrifice. And the head of the clan would gather his family together, and they would sit and they would celebrate, and they would offer sacrifices to God. And so David, being the king's son-in-law, also in the king's court, would have been expected to be at the king's festival. But he would be within his rights completely to ask the king's son in the absence of the king, because the king was where? Say it, Robin.
Wrong.
The king wasn't in town. So he would be within his rights to ask Jonathan, hey, my dad is having, he's also celebrating this feast in Bethlehem, and I need to be there. And so it's a legitimate thing. David would be in Bethlehem with his dad, so please, Mr. King, excuse me while I go down to be with my father. And Jonathan throws in later that his brother, David's brother, asked him to be there. And so David continues, verse 7. If he says good, it will be well with your servants. But if he's angry, then know that harm is determined by him. Well, that's a pretty simple test. And a pretty wisely planned one on David's part. Well, this test is not for David's benefit. He already knows. He knows exactly how Saul is thinking. David plans for Saul to demonstrate to Jonathan Saul's heart. Jonathan needs to know the extent of what's going on. David has come to his best friend. And he said, Jonathan, your dad's out to get me. It is not so, David. Surely not. My dad would tell me if that was his intent. Jonathan, you need to understand. And here's what we're going to do. There's also an aspect here of a covenant. If you remember in chapter 19, verse 6, I think that's where it was, Jonathan and David made this covenant. Right after David had defeated Goliath, everything was going well. Jonathan's and David's souls, as it says, were knit together. And they made this covenant that they were going to watch out for each other, paraphrasing. And so David is calling on that covenant. So verse 8. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there is guilt in me, kill me yourself, for why should you bring me to your father? Let's not even... If I've messed up, Jonathan, if I have failed to keep my end of the covenant, then you kill me. David knows he hasn't. Jonathan knows he hasn't. The point here is, your dad is going to kill me. Jonathan, according to our covenant, you need to protect me right now. They're kind of reading between the lines here. That's what David is saying to Jonathan. So Jonathan replies, verse 9, far be it from you. If I knew that it was determined by my father that harm should come to you, would I not tell you? Jonathan's defending himself here. Jonathan's intentions are pure. David knows that. Jonathan explains that to him, but David already knows it. Obviously, Jonathan had to have been aware of at least Saul's past intention of going after David. But again, Jonathan has been absent from the account to this point. Doesn't tell us where he was. But based on his conversation with David, he must not have been aware of what was going on. So he's kind of oblivious. So David's plans again are to show Jonathan what Saul's intents are. Now, isn't it interesting how God, in the midst of trial, provided for David this excellent friend in the most unlikely of places? I mean, this is the son of the one who's out to get him. It's the least likely place you'd expect to find your best friend. God has done something powerful for David through Jonathan. And so David is able to turn to Jonathan, his close friend, for help. And not just moral support, although I'm sure that was there. God has given David a friend that has this intimate connection, that is able to do something more than just pat him on the shoulder and say, "It'll be all right." And so Jonathan is about to just take on David's burden in ways he may not have even realized. Now, I hate to skip any of this account, but skip down to verse 14. Jonathan says to David, "If I am still alive, show me the steadfast love of the Lord that I may not die. And do not cut off your steadfast love for my house forever. When the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." And Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord take vengeance on David's enemies." And Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. I think Jonathan is aware of what's going on for some reason. I mean, look at the words. "If I'm alive, then I may not die." Jonathan knows. I don't know if he is just now catching on or what, but here he's telling David, "There's a risk involved for me in this." Somehow Jonathan has become aware of the danger. And so Jonathan commits to David. I want to skip the part about the signal that David and Jonathan worked out. It's the signal where, you know, they're going to shoot the arrows, and David's going to be hiding out in the field, and Jonathan's going to come out and shoot arrows, and so they can get together and communicate about what comes of this test that David has presented. Okay, so we're going to skip down now to verse 25. "The king sat on his seat as at other times, on the seat by the wall. Jonathan sat opposite, and Abner sat by Saul's side. But David's place was empty. Yet Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, 'Something has happened to him. He's not clean. Surely he's not clean.' But on the second day, the day after the new moon, David's place was empty. And Saul said to Jonathan, his son, 'Why has not the son of Jesse come to the meal, either yesterday or today?' Jonathan answered Saul, 'David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. He said, "Let me go, for our clan holds a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. So now, if I have found favor in your eyes, let me get away and see my brothers. For this reason, he's not come to the king's table.'" Now, can you picture this? Here's this feast. All the people around, all the important people are at the king's table. Jonathan's there. Saul's captain, Abner, is there. But there's an empty seat. And you think Saul was going to notice that empty seat? Yeah, because remember, he was looking for David. He was out to get David. I don't know how it is that anyone would have expected David to be there. I don't know if Saul was operating this clandestine thing against David kind of behind the scenes so no one knew about it. It's hard to imagine that no one in court knew about what was going on. But here's the table all set. The king's there, Abner, Jonathan, whoever else is there. One empty seat. And the first day goes by. Saul's there, and he goes, "Well, this gives evidence of Saul's respect for David and David's character. Because David would be here. David is a responsible young man. He respects me. He'll be here. He just must be ceremonially unclean and is not able to be here right now. So okay. But he doesn't say anything to anybody. He's not letting on that he's missed. It's the elephant in the room, so to speak. Everyone has to be going, oh, where's David? Saul's not going to like this. And Saul's quiet. But then the next day comes along. These feasts usually lasted 2 days because of the fact that, you know, when's the new moon, and it's a little bit. But anyway, the second day comes along. Now Saul's like, okay, the uncleanness thing works one day, but it doesn't work the second day. So it's eating at him. Jonathan, or Saul, obviously is aware of Jonathan's friendship with David, because I can picture him kind of, you know, says Jonathan sat opposite him. So he kind of hollers over the table, which means everyone hears, Jonathan, where's this son of Jesse? I didn't even call him by his name. Where's this son of Jesse? Where's David? And Jonathan, of course, lays out the planned excuse for that. And basically, Jonathan takes the heat for David and says, I gave him permission to go. David asked me if he could go to Bethlehem. I said, that was fine. Not a problem. So, here's the evidence that Saul wasn't as much in love with his son as Jonathan probably thought. Verses 30 and 31. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. And he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman! Do I not know that you've chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? Woo! Saul's a little bit upset at Jonathan. That's not what I would never talk to Josiah like that. Never. Would I, Josiah? Good. Right answer. I would never talk to my son like that. What is going on with this guy? Now Jonathan is beginning to identify with David's problem. Read on. Then Jonathan answered his father, why should he be put to death? What has he done? Jonathan stands up for David. He hadn't done anything wrong. What gives, Dad? But Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him. So Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put David to death. And Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month. For he was grieved for David, because his father had disgraced him. Now Jonathan had fully identified with David's trauma. One thing that, kind of a side note here, Saul must not have been a very good spear thrower. I mean, if you notice, he's missed David two or three times now, and he misses Jonathan. And they're sitting at a table. It's not even in battle. What's going on? This guy... That's just a whole other thing. But anyway, so Jonathan now has experienced exactly what David has experienced. He's had his own father hurl a spear at him. Man, it says he got up angry. I would either be angry or scared. I'm not sure which one. But Jonathan is angry. And he's also, what? Grieved. Why is he grieved? Not for his own sake. I think I'd be a little bit upset that my dad didn't care enough about me to maybe hit me with a spear. This is not just getting spanked with a wooden spoon, like our kids sometimes get. This is a spear, for crying out loud. His dad intended to kill him. That would grieve me a little bit. But Jonathan's not grieved for himself, or at least it doesn't record it. He's grieved for his friend. That Saul hates David so much. And David has so much respect for Saul. And has done so much for Saul. And this is what he gets for it. Jonathan now fully understands what David is going through. And begins to sink in. We're going to skip down now to verses 41 and 42. And as soon as the boy had gone, all right, let me back up because we're kind of out of context here. Jonathan goes out to the field, and they had this whole plan of how they were going to communicate, shooting bows and arrows and stuff. And so they're out in the field. David's hiding behind some rocks, and Jonathan's shot the arrows, and he sends the boy home, the servant home. Verse 41. And as soon as the boy had gone, David rose from beside the stone heap and fell on his face to the ground and bowed three times. And they kissed one another and wept with one another, David weeping the most. Then Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, because we've sworn, both of us, in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord shall be between me and you, and between my offspring and your offspring forever.'" And he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. So David and Jonathan part ways again. This would be their last meeting. They would not see each other again. And they had to have had some sense of that. I mean, here's these two guys, best friends. But they have one's father hating the other without any reason for it other than jealousy. Breaks both of their hearts. Certainly for Saul and what he had done, but also for themselves. They're not going to see each other anymore after this. So they make this vow, you know, regarding their offspring even, which David makes good on later on in his life. Well, this is a neat story. Touching, in fact, isn't it? I mean, that these guys have so much concern for one another. And there's a lot of interesting characters in it, a lot of interesting events, and we skipped a lot of it, which I hate doing, but we don't have all day to be here. There's a lot of stuff in this passage. But what are we to take away from it? I said in the beginning to watch for where David turned in this one. In the last weeks, we've seen how he turned. As he faced Goliath, he pushed through those trials, and that resistance, and he trusted God. And then as Saul began to come after him, David leaned on God for strength. And as Saul continued his pursuit, David then turned to this prophet, this man of God, and got with men of God, which we could equate to the church. Finally, today, we see David turning to his best friend. Two of them work together on this problem. Jonathan very much shared David's burden. He didn't have to. He didn't have to at all. Jonathan sacrificed greatly for his friend. But again, I just can't imagine how Jonathan had to have felt for himself that Saul so hated David that he would not only go after David, but go after his own son, Jonathan. So Jonathan identifies with David, and David with Jonathan. Well, turn finally to Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 4. This will be our closing text this morning. He's actually going to read the Our Daily Breads, which if you need a copy, they're out there in the foyer. But I was reading that last night, and Melissa and I were reading it last night. And this was part of the text. Actually, I don't even think it was the text. There was one verse on the page. And I thought, wow, that is so fitting. Let's read Ecclesiastes 4, 7 through 12. "Again, I saw a vanity under the sun, one person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil. And his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, 'For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure?' This also is vanity and an unhappy business. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. Sometimes we just need a friend. A friend to turn to. And there's nothing wrong with that. The problems still don't go away. David, even though he turned to Jonathan, I mean, we've seen him do now he's taken four different approaches to dealing with his troubles. His problems didn't go away. He continued to face those struggles. But as he shared his burden with his friend, it had to have brought some relief for David. And I think any of us who have been through trials and have shared that with a friend or a spouse recognize that that is true. No, the problems don't go away. No, the bills don't stop coming. The sickness doesn't go away. But sharing that with a friend can help. We should also be willing to be that friend. And that's the cool thing about this story is, or this account, it's not a story, it really did happen. The cool thing about this is that it wasn't just David pouring his heart out to Jonathan and David getting all his relief. David was also there for Jonathan. It was a two-way street. And the emphasis is clearly on David. But as Jonathan's grieving, as he finds out what's going on, David is also there for him. It's really an issue of both. Friendship is a two-way street. And as we face difficulties, I think God brings people into our lives, individuals at this point, friends, with whom we can share those struggles. At the same time, we're not to just pour our hearts out and never think of what we can do for someone else. Because that's going to get us in trouble. If all we think about is me, 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 what I'm going through and all my struggles, and I'm not trying to discount what anyone here is going through. But if we get so focused on my, oh, woe is me, we won't ever take time to listen to someone else's trouble. We're going to be miserable. And I think that was one of the ways that David dealt with this trouble. I'm going to break this news to my best friend as gently as I can. He could have laid it on Jonathan a whole lot harder than he did. But David was aware of his friendship and of his friend's needs. Even though David certainly had needs. So the call to you today is, are you a David or a Jonathan? And I think both is where we need to be. We're giving and taking. We're sharing the burden. Let me emphasize that of these four responses that we've looked at over the past few weeks, I'm not suggesting that you just pick one and go with it. Obviously, the first two are ones that we do every time. We trust in God. We call out to Him for strength. But these last two, I think, go hand in hand with that. We look to God's people. We look to the church, prophets, for strength, for encouragement, and see what the Holy Spirit does through that. And we also look to that one person that is our best friend. Or those two people that are our best friends. And again, these have to go hand in hand. Because guess what? Our best friends can let us down. We've all been there. Our best friends let us down. And so it's critical that we lean most heavily on those first two things. trusting in God and leaning on Him for strength. The church is going to let us down too, because it's made of people. We all, every single person in this church has their own burdens that they're bearing. Sometimes we think that my burden is the heaviest burden. No one has a burden as heavy as I do. And as I listen to burdens from various people, I think, oh my goodness, I can't imagine having to deal with that. And that's a proper response. I'm sure David couldn't imagine having to deal with his father as Jonathan was dealing with his father. David's heart had to have broken for his best friend, as Jonathan's broke for David. They shared a burden. They shared each other's burdens. And so must we. Life isn't easy for anyone. We live in a sin-sick world. A world affected by sin, corrupted by sin, which means every single person in this room either is or is going to face troubles. Where will you turn?